Welcome to the Awake Nations TV podcast. Download our apps and watch our shows at awakenations.tv.
Welcome to Awake Nations TV. I actually want to start today by turning the mirror directly toward you, the listener, and asking you to take inventory of a very specific internal landscape right now.
Oh, diving right in.
Yeah, right into the deep end. Because in the quiet moments of your life, maybe when you wake up at 3 a.m. or, you know, during your commute when the radio is just off, do you feel this underlying, unexplainable sense of restlessness?
Mm-hmm. That slow motion transition.
Exactly. Like, is there a disruption happening that you can't quite articulate? It often manifests as this persistent, gnawing sensation that the solid ground beneath your feet is slowly turning to sand.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to describe it.
Right. The routines, the roles, the relationships, or even the career paths that used to feel incredibly secure, suddenly they feel fragile or hollow or somehow just expired.
Expired is such a good word for it.
So if that description resonates with the friction you're experiencing right now, you are sitting in the exact right place for today's deep dive.
You know, that sensation of shifting ground, it's actually a universal human experience, but it is one of the most chronically misinterpreted seasons of our lives.
How so? Like, why do we misinterpret it so badly?
Well, because when the familiar structures begin to tremble, our default human reflex is just sheer panic. I mean, we immediately assume a catastrophic failure has occurred.
Right, like we did something wrong.
Exactly. We search for a breach in the hull, assuming we made some fatal miscalculation, or that we're being actively opposed by a hostile force. But the framework we are exploring today flips that entire narrative completely on its head.
And we are unpacking a really spiritually weighty, profoundly practical book today, right?
We are. It's an intensely prophetic book by Glenn Bleakney titled Unsettled, The Unexpected Path to God's Purpose. And our objective here is to really map out the anatomy of what is actually happening when God actively and intentionally interrupts our meticulously crafted plans.
To lead us into a new assignment. See, the natural assumption is that divine intervention only happens to pull us out of a pit, you know? Mm. We view God as the ultimate rescue worker.
Mm-hmm. The crisis manager.
Right. If things are going well, if the season is fruitful and comfortable, our theology basically tells us that God's job is just to maintain the status quo, keep the good times rolling.
Yeah, but the paradigm shift Bleakney introduces is jarring. He argues that God will often intentionally sabotage a perfectly good, fruitful season. He will deliberately unsettle the comfortable.
Which is wild to think about. Why would an all-knowing God disrupt a system that is currently working?
Well, understanding the mechanics of that requires us to look at the difference between recognizing what God is doing versus understanding how and why he does it.
Oh, that's a big distinction.
It is. The book frames this as the critical distinction between discerning God's acts and discerning his ways.
Okay, can you break that down a bit more? Acts versus ways.
Sure. To really grasp the magnitude of that distinction, you have to look at the psychological difference between a consumer and a participant. Bleakney actually draws on the historical narrative of the Israelites in the wilderness to illustrate this.
Wilderness wanderings, yeah.
Right. So the masses of people, they were intimately familiar with God's acts. They were the consumers of miracles. I mean, they saw the Red Sea part physically.
Right. They gathered literal bread falling from the sky.
Exactly, the manna. So they were hyper aware of these spectacular outward manifestations, the what. But they were constantly terrified and prone to rebellion because an acts-based relationship is entirely transactional.
If the act stops, the relationship falls apart.
You nailed it. If the manna doesn't appear one morning, the consumer immediately assumes abandonment. Moses, however, he pursued God's ways.
He wanted the why.
He wanted to understand the character, the underlying logic, the overarching strategy, the why and the how, not just the what.
I mean, that transactional mindset is incredibly prevalent today. We basically treat our spirituality like a vending machine.
That's a great analogy.
It's true, though. If I put in the correct currency of, you know, prayer, good behavior, hard work, the machine dispenses a blessing or an open door or a promotion.
And if it doesn't?
If the machine suddenly stops working, or worse, if it takes my coin and gives me absolute nothing, my entire worldview collapses. I start kicking the machine, assuming it's broken.
Right, because you're focused on the axe.
Exactly. But if I understand the ways of the designer, I might realize the machine was unplugged on purpose, you know, because I'm being relocated to a different building.
Wow, yes. Knowing his ways means understanding that he operates through deliberate seasons. It means recognizing that preparation often looks a lot like deprivation.
Deprivation, that's a tough pill to swallow.
It is. It means accepting that intentional disruption is a tool used to shape character and forcefully align us with a larger narrative that we just can't see yet.
So when you filter your life through that lens, the lens of God's ways, the emotional response to a closed door fundamentally changes, doesn't it?
Completely. A closed door ceases to be this traumatic event of abandonment and is instead accurately identified as a divine redirection.
Which brings us to the first major pillar of Bleakney's framework, right? The divine disruption.
Yes. And he explores this phenomenon of God intentionally unsettling the familiar, not from some detached theoretical standpoint. He uses a very visceral personal account of what he terms a season of scattering.
A season of scattering. What did that look like for him?
He details this period where a community he had poured his life into essentially dissolved. The foundations were shaken, and leaders who had operated in tight-knit synergy were suddenly scattered in wildly different directions.
That sounds devastating.
It was. The entire infrastructure of his life and ministry was abruptly dismantled.
I mean, the psychological toll of that kind of systemic collapse is immense, because it isn't just the loss of a job title or a weekly meeting. It is the loss of identity. When the community you helped build fragments, the immediate internal narrative is usually one of intense shame. Like, we look back at the rubble and revise our own history. We tell ourselves, well, since this ended in disaster, it must have been a mistake from the very beginning.
We built it wrong.
I misheard God. Right. The human brain desperately wants to find the error so it can avoid the pain in the future. But Bleakney injects a radical thought here, doesn't he?
He really does. He says that a divine ending does not automatically equal a past failure.
That specific realization is an absolute lifeline for anyone currently standing in the ashes of a concluded season.
It's vital. We have to separate the validity of a season from its longevity. We have this erroneous belief that if something is truly of God, it's just going to last forever.
Right, permanent success.
But seasons are, by definition, temporary. God was entirely present in the building of that community, and God was entirely sovereign in the dismantling of it because its appointed time had simply expired.
Wow. So to understand the mechanism of this dismantling, Bleakney categorizes three distinct ways God typically moves us, drawing on historical biblical patterns. What's the first one?
The first method is the outright disruption of our plans. And the archetype for this is Joseph in the book of Genesis.
Oh, Joseph's trajectory is the ultimate study in divine disruption. I mean, he is given a clear vision of leadership and influence, a literal dream of his family bowing to him.
Right. But the immediate sequential reality is violently opposite to that vision.
Violently opposite. He is thrown into a pit by his own brothers, sold into human trafficking, falsely accused of assault, and thrown into a foreign prison.
It's just one disaster after another.
Yeah. If we look at that purely through the lens of our own modern plans, every single step is a catastrophic detour. Like, we would hold prayer meetings to bind the spirit of the pit, right? Mm. To fight the injustice of the slavery, to break the chains of the prison. We treat the detour as the enemy.
Yes, we treat it as the enemy because we fail to realize the detour is the actual vehicle of transportation.
Ooh, the vehicle of transportation. I like that.
The disruption was not a delay in Joseph's destiny. It was the prerequisite curriculum for it. I mean, think about it. The pit, the slavery, the prison, those were the precise geographical and psychological coordinates required to position him in the palace.
At the exact moment a global famine hit.
Exactly. The disruption stripped away his arrogance, it forged his administrative capabilities in the dark, and it placed him in the direct path of the Pharaoh's cupbearer.
So God didn't just passively allow the disruption.
No, he actively utilized the disruption of Joseph's localized, comfortable plan to save entire nations from starvation.
That is heavy. Okay, so the second mechanism Bleakney identifies is the dissipation of our resources.
Yeah.
And the biblical anchor for this is the prophet Elijah.
Yes, the brook Cherith.
Right. Elijah is commanded to hide by this brook, where he experiences this bizarre, miraculous provision. Ravens are literally bringing him meat and bread. But then the brook dries up.
The water just stops.
The water simply stops flowing. And what fascinates me about this is the psychological torture of a drying brook. Because it rarely happens overnight, you know? It's a slow, agonizing process.
You're watching it drop inch by inch.
Day by day. You keep checking, hoping it will rain, hoping the provision will return.
And that slow dissipation is incredibly intentional. God is systematically starving Elijah out of his comfort zone.
Wow.
See, the season at the Brook was authentic, it was miraculous, and it was ordained, but it was over. The dried up Brook was not an indicator of God's anger, nor was it a failure of Elijah's faith.
It was just a mechanical lever.
A lever God pulled to force Elijah to relocate to Zarephath, where the next critical phase of his assignment awaited. And the miraculous provision for a starving widow was there too.
Right, because if the Brook had continued to flow, Elijah would have pitched a permanent tent there?
Oh, absolutely. He would have chosen the comfort of the familiar provision over the uncertainty of the new assignment. And God will dry up the resources in your current season, whether that's financial backing, emotional fulfillment, creative energy to compel you to move.
That is so confronting. Okay, the third method is arguably the most painful because it involves human collateral. Bleakney points to the dissolution of relationships.
It is tough.
He uses the historical account of the Apostle Paul and Barnabas. Now, this is a severe disruption because Barnabas was the one who initially advocated for Paul when the rest of the leadership was utterly terrified of him.
He was his sponsor, basically.
Right. And they forged this dynamic, highly effective partnership. They're traveling, planting communities together. But eventually, a sharp, irreconcilable disagreement arises between them over personnel, and they sever the partnership.
To just walk away from each other.
Yeah. And my immediate pushback when reading this is that our entire theological framework prioritizes unity.
Right.
We are taught that division is inherently destructive. So how can the fracturing of a healthy, productive relationship be a tool of divine repositioning?
It definitely challenges our idealized notion of unity, certainly. We often conflate unity with uniformity or just geographical proximity.
Yeah.
But we have to look at the structural outcome of that painful separation.
Okay. What was the outcome?
Well, instead of one concentrated apostolic team covering a single route, the division forced the creation of two distinct teams. Paul took Silas one way, Barnabas took Mark another.
So the geographical footprint doubled.
Doubled overnight. Sometimes God will permit a profound relational fracturing because the individuals involved have become a ceiling to each other's growth.
Wow, they become a ceiling to each other.
Yes. The relational comfort becomes an incubator that actually prevents them from taking the risks necessary for the next level of expansion.
Mm.
So God will allow the dissolution of the partnership to multiply the work and force both parties into new territories they never would have explored.
Had they just remained comfortably tethered together, that reframes the entire concept of relational endings. It is a harsh reality, but it's really similar to a great chapter in a novel ending, you know.
Enemy.
Well, you become deeply invested in the setting, the synergy between the characters, the pacing of the plot. And when that chapter concludes, there is a literal physical blank space on the page.
Oh, yeah.
We often stare at that blank space and mourn, forgetting that the author is simply turning the page to advance the narrative. I mean, the plot requires a new setting and a new conflict. The ending of the current chapter is the absolute prerequisite for the rest of the book to even exist.
That author analogy is incredibly precise because it addresses the sovereignty behind the transition.
Yeah.
God is holding the pen. However, recognizing that the page is turning brings us to a highly complex point of practical discernment, because we are faced with the challenge of identifying what the new chapter is actually supposed to entail.
Yeah, what are we supposed to do now?
Exactly. When the familiar structures are dismantled, we are left standing in the rubble, forced to evaluate what we have been building. And Bleakney introduces a concept here that serves as a diagnostic tool for our current state of exhaustion.
What does he call it?
He calls it tending your own vineyard. It's anchored in this very raw confession found in the Song of Songs, chapter 1, verse 6. They forced me to care for their vineyards, so I couldn't care for myself, my own vineyard.
That verse is a diagnostic laser beam because it exposes the hidden danger of cultivating everyone else's vision while completely neglecting the specific plot of land God entrusted to you.
It's so easy to do.
It is. The danger is subtle because tending someone else's vineyard doesn't look like rebellion, right? It looks like noble service. It looks like teamwork.
It looks like you're just being a good Christian.
Exactly. It is incredibly easy, especially for competent, sincere individuals, to become an indispensable cog in someone else's machine. I mean, it is infinitely safer to manage a vineyard that someone else planted.
The infrastructure is already there.
The funding is there. The momentum is established. Building your own vineyard from the dirt up requires a level of risk and exposure that most people subconsciously avoid by just hiding in the shadow of a larger organization.
Bleakney actually shares a profound internal audit he underwent during his own season of scattering. He realized he had spent years faithfully pouring his lifeblood into other people's visions.
Just working their fields.
Right. He had strategized, labored, and exhausted himself to build other leaders' ministries. Now, he explicitly notes that he did this without regret. It was a season of faithful stewardship.
So it wasn't a sin.
No, not at all. However, the revelation was that while he was being a stellar employee in another man's field, he had become an absentee landlord to his own calling. Yeah. God had given him a highly specific, unique mandate to build Awake Nations. And the realization hit him that he was emotionally and spiritually bankrupt, not because he was doing evil things, but because he was spending all his finite energy tending a field he was never commissioned to manage indefinitely.
See, that mechanism explains so much of the chronic burnout we see today. People just assume they are burnt out because they're working too hard. But what if the exhaustion isn't a volume problem?
What if it's an alignment problem?
Exactly. You can work 80 hours a week in your designated vineyard and feel a deep, sustaining grace. But you can work 20 hours a week in a vineyard you aren't graced for and feel completely crushed by the weight of it.
The grace is specific to the assignment.
It is. I want to pause the analysis for a second here and direct this straight to you, the listener. What is the specific, unique vineyard God has personally entrusted to you?
That's the million-dollar question.
Are you running on fumes right now because you are trapped in the momentum of someone else's vision? Like, are you keeping their field perfectly manicured while the unique mandate God handed you is overgrown with weeds and just gathering dust on a shelf?
Stepping out of that secondary role and taking ownership of your own vineyard, it rarely happens in a vacuum, though.
Right. It takes a shift.
It almost always requires an environmental and sometimes literal shift. Bleakney describes this transition through a framework he calls the geography of obedience.
The geography of obedience.
For Bleakney and his wife, Lynn, this was not metaphorical at all. It required a physical relocation. They were prompted to leave a region of high comfort where they possessed deep relational equity and historical roots to move to an entirely new hemisphere.
They went to Australia, right?
Yes, eventually settling in Australia. They knew virtually no one. It was a complete geographic reset. But he makes a razor-sharp distinction here. This relocation was driven by a mandate to go, not a desire to escape.
Okay, let's dissect the psychology of escapism for a minute, because it masquerades as obedience all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
If I am in a high-friction environment, maybe I despise my current boss, or my local community is going through a really tedious, uninspiring season, or honestly, I am just generally bored. My flesh wants relief. And the easiest way to get relief is to change my zip code or change my job. It is terrifyingly easy to spiritualize that desire for comfort, pack my bags, and proudly announce, well, God is calling me into a new season.
Right, when the reality is you're just running away from conflict.
Exactly. I can move my physical body 3,000 miles away, but I will drag every single ounce of my unhealed bitterness, poor conflict resolution skills, and internal dysfunction right along with me. Geography, in and of itself, heals absolutely nothing.
That is the exact trap Bleakney warns against. He categorically states that not all restlessness is holy.
That's a quote to write down.
Right. We inhabit a culture that constantly feeds us the illusion that the grass is greener elsewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, social media algorithms are literally designed to induce a perpetual state of thermo fear of missing out.
And we confuse that with the Holy Spirit.
Exactly. This artificial, culturally induced anxiety can easily be mistaken for a divine nudge. So we have to ruthlessly interrogate our own motives. Are we experiencing a genuine divine repositioning? Or are we just dealing with a roaming heart fueled by temporary frustration, deep-seated offense, or raw personal ambition?
Am I just ambitious and impatient?
Often what we interpret as a call to transition is simply our ego demanding a platform without being willing to endure the preparation.
The demand for the platform without the preparation. Man, that is the disease of the modern era. We want the influence, but we despise the obscurity required to handle the influence safely.
We don't want the hidden years.
No. Bleakney points back to the biblical wilderness years, which are universally despised, but absolutely critical. We look at a figure like King David, right? He is officially anointed as king as a teenager, but the transition to the throne isn't instantaneous.
Not at all.
He spends years as a fugitive, hiding in literal caves, leading a band of societal rejects, constantly on the run from a paranoid, murderous king. Or Moses, who spends 40 hidden, silent years in the desert, tending someone else's sheep before he is deemed ready to confront an empire.
If David or Moses had acted on ambition alone, If they had yielded to the fleshly urge to forcefully seize their new season prematurely, they would have been utterly crushed by the weight of the assignment.
The character wouldn't have been there to sustain it.
Exactly. A false sense of transition is often just our internal lack of discipline trying to bypass the painful, hidden character-forging phase. We desperately want to skip the desert curriculum and parachute directly into the promised land.
So how do we know the difference?
Well, Bleakney provides a rigorous 5-part diagnostic test to discern if the urge to move is genuinely the Lord or just our own impatience trying to pick a lock.
Okay, let's go through these. And these tests cannot just be a checklist we breeze through. They have vital fail-safes. So the first test is alignment with the Word of God.
The foundational guardrail.
Right. God will never author a transition that violates his established character or his written principles. If your new season requires you to abandon your family, act with deceit, or compromise your integrity, it is not a divine mandate. It is a deception, period.
Yeah. The second test is the peace of God. But this one is tricky.
Yeah. How do we define peace when the actual act of transitioning might involve selling a house, quitting a secure job, and moving into the unknown? I mean, that process is inherently stressful.
Yeah.
How does peace coexist with circumstantial chaos?
It's a great question. The peace of God in this context is not the absence of external turbulence. It is the presence of an internal anchor. It is a deep water peace. Think of it this way. The surface of the ocean might be experiencing a Category 5 hurricane. But if you drop a submarine a few hundred feet down, the water is entirely still.
I love that image.
When a transition is born of fleshly escapism, the internal state is frantic, manic, and driven by anxiety. You feel like you are outrunning a ghost. But when it is a holy redirection, your circumstances might be terrifying and your logical brain might be screaming about the financial risk. But at the core of your spirit, there is a profound, unshakable stillness.
You just know.
You know, beyond logic, that you are in the center of the current.
Okay. The third test requires stepping outside of our own echo chamber, godly counsel. The mandate here is that you were never designed to navigate major transitions in isolation. You must submit your revelation to the scrutiny of spiritual mentors and mature peers.
Absolutely essential.
But I have to push back here on the complexity of human dynamics.
Yep.
What if the mentor you seek counsel from is inherently biased? What if they rely on you to run their vineyard? And they subconsciously or consciously give you counsel that serves their retention strategy rather than your destiny. How do we navigate conflicting advice from people who all claim to love the Lord?
That is a highly sophisticated challenge. Discernment requires distinguishing between counsel that is invested in you and counsel that is merely dependent on you.
Invested versus dependent.
Yes. True godly counsel will always prioritize your ultimate alignment with God over their personal convenience. If you present your transition to three mature, objective mentors who have nothing to lose or gain by your departure, and all three of them raise severe red flags and tell you to pump the brakes, you must possess the humility to pause.
You have to listen.
Arrogance dismisses counsel because it believes its own internal monologue is infallible. Humility recognizes that God often uses the community to reveal blind spots we cannot see in the mirror.
That is so good. Okay, the fourth test involves the alignment of circumstances and open doors. Now, this comes with a massive caveat, right?
Yeah, huge caveat.
We cannot adopt a theology that reads the tea leaves of minor inconveniences, like, I hit a red light on the way to the interview, therefore God is closing the door. That is superstition, not discernment.
Right, we aren't looking for omens.
However, God does orchestrate sovereign alignments. He will move pieces on the board that you have absolutely no control over. An opportunity will materialize out of thin air, or a seemingly secure position will suddenly evaporate. Circumstances shouldn't be the sole driver, but they act as corroborating evidence to the internal peace and the external counsel.
Exactly. And the final ultimate lie detector is the fifth test, the fruit over time.
Time tells all.
It really does. A genuine divine repositioning, no matter how clumsy the initial execution might be, will eventually bear the fruit of the Spirit. It'll produce greater reliance on God, a wider impact for the kingdom, and an internal maturation.
And if it's fake.
Conversely, a transition rooted in offense, escapism, or unchecked ambition will inevitably bear the fruit of division, exhaustion, and recurring cycles of the exact same trauma you thought you were leaving behind. Time is the ultimate exposer of motives.
Let's follow the timeline forward then. You do the rigorous work. You pass the tests. The word aligns. The deep water peace is present. Objective counsel confirms it. The doors align. You possess the absolute certainty that the author is turning the page.
You ready to go?
Right. But the brutal reality that we often gloss over is that absolute certainty does not eradicate the pain of departure. Even when you know God is in it, ending a season is an act of amputation.
It's severing a limb.
It is. Which brings us to a deeply pastoral element of Bleakney's message. Navigating the grief of a good thing ended. We have a toxic habit in some spiritual circles of demanding that people instantly rejoice in transition, forcing them to spiritualize their pain away with platitudes like, well, God has something better for you.
Ugh, yes. That toxic positivity entirely bypasses the necessary mechanism of grief. When you leave a familiar season, you are experiencing a legitimate death.
You really are.
You are losing a version of your daily life, a specific rhythm of relationships, and a certain operational identity. Bleakney is highly empathetic to this. Experiencing divine disruption physically hurts. You have to allow yourself to process that loss.
And if you don't?
If you refuse to grieve the ending of the previous chapter, that suppressed emotion will inevitably calcify into bitterness. And bitterness is the deadliest hazard in any transition.
Bitterness acts as a massive rusted anchor. I have seen brilliant, capable people receive a clear mandate for a new vineyard, but they cannot sail their ship out of the harbor because they have dropped an anchor of resentment deep into the mud of their past season.
They're stuck.
They spend all their time obsessing over how they were treated on their way out, who didn't support them, or how the organization failed them. Bleakney addresses this brilliantly by reframing the mechanism of a closed door.
How does he frame it?
Well, we assume a closed door is a personal rejection from the people holding the handle, right? We take it as an insult to our value. But Bleakney states that a closed door is not a rejection from man. It is a redirection from the Lord.
Internalizing that truth neurologically rewires how you experience loss.
It changes everything.
Because if you believe the board of directors or your ex-partner or your former friend group rejected you, you will spend years nursing that wound, plotting your vindication.
You become obsessed.
But if you recognize that God sovereignly allowed their hearts to harden or their vision to shift, specifically to evict you from a space you had outgrown, the offense just dissolves.
Wow.
You realize the people who rejected you were merely unwitting instruments used to launch you into your actual assignment. You can walk away with clean hands, honoring what God accomplished in that space during its appointed time without harboring any animosity toward the instruments of your exit.
Leaving well is a rare art form. It really requires immense grace. But once you navigate the exit, you don't immediately arrive at the destination, do you?
No, you don't.
This introduces one of the most profound and psychologically taxing concepts in the entire deep dive. The hallway.
The hallway.
The hallway is that sterile, echoing, liminal space between seasons. The door to the previous chapter has slammed shut and the lock has engaged. You cannot go backward. But the door to the promised new vineyard is stubbornly shut. You are trapped in a transitional corridor.
It feels entirely unproductive.
It feels like God put your life on a layaway plan and forgot about you.
The hallway is the wilderness. It is the ultimate waiting room. And the critical error we make is assuming that because the hallway feels unproductive, it is a waste of time.
But it's not.
Bleakney insists that the hallway is actually the primary theater of spiritual formation. Is where the deepest, most aggressive discipleship occurs.
Why?
Because in the previous room, your identity was likely propped up by external scaffolding. Your title, your income, the applause of your peers, the measurable success of your output. In the hallway, all that scaffolding is violently stripped away. You have no title. You have no measurable output. You are reduced to your absolute core.
The mechanism of the waiting room is purification by deprivation. If my identity was secretly tied to my performance, the hallway will expose that idol immediately because I will spiral into a severe depression when I can't perform.
Exactly.
The hallway forces the question, am I okay with just being loved by God when I am entirely useless to the machine? And the immense danger here is that our instinct in the hallway is isolation. We feel exposed.
We want to hide.
We feel like failures because we don't have a neat, tightly bowed testimony to share on a stage. We want to retreat into a cave and only emerge once the new door opens and we look successful again.
But isolation in the hallway is fatal because you are most vulnerable to the lies of the enemy when you are devoid of external markers of success. Bleakney emphatically argues that you must remain fiercely planted in community during the transition.
You need a tether.
You need people who can bear witness to your process, who can speak truth over your naked identity when your professional identity is gone. The community is the tether that keeps you from drifting into despair while you wait.
Because the theological promise is what?
The promise is this. God never abandons his servants in the corridor. He is not a sadistic deity who enjoys watching you squirm in the waiting room. Every second spent in the hallway is heavily calculated preparation for the specific weight of the glory that exists behind the next door.
We have dissected a massive amount of theological and psychological architecture today. We've looked at the trauma of the divine disruption, the danger of tending the wrong vineyard, the rigor of testing the shift, the necessity of grieving without bitterness, and the purifying fire of the hallway.
It's a lot to process.
It is. But theory is useless until it becomes biography. The entire purpose of this deep dive is to force a collision between this material and the reality of your life right now. So we're going to slow the pace down and deliver some heavy, searching questions. These are not rhetorical. I want you to let the gravity of these questions pull on your current circumstances.
Consider the inventory of your life as it stands today. What may God be gently, or perhaps forcefully, bringing to a close? Look for the areas where the grace has simply evaporated.
Or it just feels too hard.
Is there a specific role you occupy? A relationship dynamic you rely on? A geographical location, or even a deeply held mindset that feels like you are constantly swimming against the current to maintain?
Because sometimes the internal friction arrives months before the external circumstances change. Are you fighting to resuscitate a season that God has already pronounced dead?
That requires brutal honesty. Let's look at the second question. When the noise of everyone else's demands is muted, when you aren't trying to appease your family, your boss, or your social circle, what is the specific burden that continually returns to haunt your private prayers?
What keeps you up at night?
What is the problem in the world that infuriates you? What is the vision that you dismiss as impossible, yet it refuses to leave you alone? That recurring burden is the blueprint for the unique vineyard you are actually commissioned to tend.
And the final diagnostic question. Are you currently sitting in front of a securely locked door, exhausted from banging your fist against it, pleading with God to remove the demonic resistance blocking your path?
Is it possible that the locked door is not an attack from hell, but rather God's merciful insistence that you turn around and walk away?
Wow.
Are you stubbornly trying to pick the lock on a door that God sovereignly deadbolted for your own protection? Because he knows that what is behind that door will ultimately shrink your destiny.
The beauty of Bleakney's premise is the profound hope that anchors it. You know, you are not a victim of random chaotic circumstances. You are in the hands of a God who meticulously goes before you.
I am.
If he is allowing the page to turn, if he is slowly drying up your brook, if he is permitting the dismantling of your comfort, it is guaranteed that he has already prepared the architecture of your next assignment. The new vineyard exists. The soil is ready. But you must possess the courage to drop the tools of the old season and walk into the unknown.
Because of the sheer gravity of what we have navigated today, I want to cross the boundary from analysis into intercession. I want to take a moment to pray directly for you as you stand in the tension of your own transition.
Please do.
Lord, I bring every single individual listening to this right now before you. I ask that you would drop a profound, penetrating spiritual discernment into their minds. Give them the capacity to recognize your deeper ways, to look past the disruptive acts, and see the loving strategy behind them. Grant them the absolute clarity to separate a genuine holy redirection from the noisy distractions of escapism and ambition. I pray for an infusion of raw courage to step fully into the sterile unknown hallway, trusting implicitly that your presence occupies that space. Give them the humility to submit their plans to godly counsel, rejecting the pride of isolation. And finally, Lord, I ask for a supernatural impartation of grace, the grace to let go of the past well, the grace to honor what was built without allowing a single microscopic root of bitterness or offense to take hold in their spirit. Prepare their hands for the exact vineyard you have ordained for them, in your name.
If God is unsettling what has become familiar, continue the journey in Glenn Bleakney's book, Unsettled, The Unexpected Path to God's Purpose. Visit unsettledbook.com and watch more spirit-led kingdom teaching at awakennations.tv.
Thanks for listening to the Awake Nations TV podcast. Subscribe today and enjoy inspiring kingdom content completely free at awakenations.tv.